Welcome to Leadership Line of Sight. My name is Taylor, and I am your host today, and I'm joined by somebody who is doing something that shouldn't be underestimated. When we talk about our next steps into the quantum computing age, when we discuss computers that are capable of doing 10,000 years of work in 3 minutes, we have to talk about the security element of that. So today, we have the Chief Product Officer with QSecure, Rebecca Crothamer. It's a pleasure to see you. Thanks for joining with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And I know that you're coming to us from Washington, D.C. I imagine that work takes you everywhere.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I've been out in D.C. since Tuesday. Home base is California, but yeah, we go all over. We were out in Minnesota recently. It was just in Austin. And that's where we met you, actually.
I got to give a shout out to Joseph. He was the one who I ended up coming in contact with at Strangeworks. You know, spending the day at Strangeworks, you'll always meet such interesting people. And that's something that made it possible for us to get together today.
That's awesome. Yeah. Cheers to Joseph, a great human.
Great humans. Way to go, Joseph. So I think that maybe understanding a little bit about where we're going when it comes to quantum computing is, do you have any idea of like how many qubits we're at so far as like that are out there? I know that we're under a gig, right?
Yeah. Yes. So, okay. So where we're at with qubits, it's kind of a complex question to answer. But I'll make it as simple as possible. Basically, we like to think of qubits in terms of, how many there are on a chip. And it doesn't really scale like a classical computer. So I'm on a laptop. It's got 16 gig of RAM, right? If I wanted to double my processing power, I'd need another 16 gig of RAM. I'd need another computer. But if I have a quantum computer that has, say, 50 qubits, and I want to double my processing power, I need one more qubit. So 51 qubits is twice as powerful as 50 qubits. And so that means it scales in a pretty awesome way. And so back to your question, I think IBM right now has the record for publicly for having just over 400 qubits. Now, there's a little bit of nuance when it comes to the quality of qubits and what it means to be an error-corrected qubit versus a not error-corrected qubit. So number doesn't always mean everything you want it to mean, but that's where we stand right now. And we're kind of getting to this dividing line where the next chip that IBM wants to put out is about 1,000 qubits. And there's a lot of talk about whatever comes after this 400, do we make it public? Do we not? Because you can start doing some really, really cool things with that. And to bring it back to the cybersecurity side, the threat, there's the idea that at a certain scale, quantum computers will break our encryption that keeps stuff safe as data travels over networks. And that number that we need is about 4,000 error-corrected qubits. So just to put everything into perspective.
That does bring it into perspective because like if we were talking about traditionally, if I know that when we were moving through computers in the 1960s, they were kind of counting up. It more, I guess, to my age, it was like modems where like the first modems, those 14 fours, those types of things that were becoming popular in the retail world. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of count up from there until we get like broadband internet, right?
Yeah, right.
And this is such like we're so early into this. Yeah. How do you handle the fact that it's going so fast?
Yeah, well, gosh, it's really very exciting. And you know, for me, one of the main reasons I got into quantum computing is because I came from the AI world. And, you know, everybody knows about AI and generative AI and how it's going. And it's taken off. But quantum is going to unlock so many doors, not just in AI, but in a lot of sides of technology. And so for me, being at the very forefront, having the opportunity to be in it when, you know, Jack Hittery of Sandbox counted the number of people in quantum at that time, and it was like 800 people in the U.S., which is amazing, right? Just 800 people defining what this huge industry is going to be. And I think there's a good number more now. Everyone now knows what quantum is. But it's moving incredibly fast. And I think, you know, people to your point, people make an analogy. We're in the 1960s of classical computing with quantum, but it's not going to take another 50 years to get to where we want to be with quantum because we have so many more tools. There's so much going into it. There's a lot of funding going into it. So I think this next five years in quantum is going to be huge. And just to put in a plug for kind of thinking about how we build the foundations, I'm big into technology ethics. So it's a really good opportunity for us to really be thinking about how we use these things as it goes really, really quickly.
Well, you were actually part of a World Economic Forum group studying ethics specifically around privacy.
Yeah, absolutely. So
when you think about privacy in a quantum world, what comes to mind?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I think that the top two things, and of course, the bubble that I'm in with my company, we are focusing on solving the quantum threat problem. And so, again, to illustrate what the quantum threat looks like, it's the idea that all of our data as it travels, right? So whether it's us talking right now, if this is encrypted, your text messages, anything that from social media, your email, anything that goes across networks, and you want it to be encrypted and private, that's exactly the kind of data that gets cracked by something called Shor's algorithm, and a quantum computer. And so we don't want that, right? We want our data to remain safe. And you think about other things like bank account information, like national security, electronic health records. That essentially we need to get ahead of that. We need to encrypt. But there will at South by Southwest in Austin, we heard from the CTO of the CIA, and he likened this to a, hey, everybody, be careful what you put into writing these days, because there's going to be a quantum WikiLeaks, is what he said. So making it very real for people. Some data is going to be leaked. And I think there's a move to move faster than not to encrypt data properly so that doesn't happen. And I think the second piece of that is people kind of liken it to Y2K, right? This idea that at midnight on January 1st, 2000, it's going to, there's going to be an event. And I would say the one difference here with quantum is that we don't have time to wait until that quantum computer comes around, because there's this idea of store now, decrypt later. And because data travels across networks, you can intercept it. So a very popular type of attack is store now, decrypt later. So it's a bit of a long-winded answer.
Open that door a little bit. So store now and decrypt later.
Store now, decrypt
later. My friends that are involved in intelligence, what they say is, historically, when we take a look at the North American approach to gathering data, it's to understand what's important first and then try to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Where store now, decrypt later would probably be described as the number one policy of a group like China.
Yes. When, we can't know exactly what's being collected, but I've heard, 25% of our data in transit has been harvested. That's a number that gets thrown around, right? So to your point, yes, grab everything, sit on it, data's cheap to store. And then once you have the power, decrypt it.
And then to go further into that, when we talk about anything that's designed to make security, it's normally based on time. So when you think about fire safety, it's how long until this burns. When you think about prisons, they actually rate the doors in how many hours of untooled attack they would withstand. So when you're talking about computers that are capable, like I was referencing in our introduction, the Google, when they were talking about quantum supremacy, they could do 10,000 years worth of work in 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that someone inside of a prison could do 10,000 years worth of damage to a door. There would be no door that would withstand them. Is that an accurate understanding of what you're looking to try to prevent?
That is so well put. I love that. I might use that. Thank you. that's exactly right. So the algorithms we use today, we use them because they're mathematically really, really, really hard to break with today's computers and the way that today's computers process. Like there's, proofs that no matter how powerful we make today's computers, it's going to be really hard for them to break today's encryption. Enter quantum computers that think in a totally different way. And turns out, uh-oh, they're very good at that kind of math. And so, yeah, those are the doors. The doors that we use today, typically, are supposed to be those doors that last for 10,000 years. Quantum makes it, you know, a 3-minute door, essentially. And so it's a very good analogy. The answer to it is that there are new algorithms. And so it's really just a matter of implementing these new algorithms that are 10,000 year doors for classical. And they're also 10,000 year doors for quantum. And we can basically prove that in a mathematical way that neither quantum logic or classical logic can beat through these doors in a reasonable amount of time.
I want to unpack that a little bit. So for those people that look at blockchain, they need to understand that the reason that blockchain stacks is because it's like a computational blind spot related to prime numbers. Is that a good way to describe it?
Sure. Yeah.
So then a computer that is limited to that, like classical computers, it makes blockchain very secure. Mm-hmm. But a quantum computer wouldn't even consider that a light snack.
A light snack. Yeah. Yeah. And there are, you know, a lot of blockchain security relies on the same, you know, math that 10,000 year door for today's computers that we do, where, you know, other types of data as it travels, that prime factorization problem. So that's exactly right.
And then the combination, like, I like how this quantum computing and artificial intelligence are kind of walking hand in hand. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would see it the same way, but the way that I see it is artificial intelligence is the interface for quantum computing. Like it's like the keyboard.
Ooh, interesting. I like that. As in you use like AI as a way to interact with quantum and to get the most out of it. I think Worley talks about this, right?
Yeah, I was actually talking to him a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such an important time right now, is because when we take a look at what used to take us, like, we're 83 years ahead of 1960, mm-hmm. where computers took up entire rooms. And now, if you were to compare yourself to somebody in 1960, you would have more power in your pocket than the richest person on the planet.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And to use that same analogy, right? you know, I think... was it Watson at IBM famously said, I think there's a global market for, like, you know, 5 computers. You know, IBM led the charge, and again, are leading the charge in quantum. They led the charge in classical computing. And I think to draw another analogy, it's such early days with quantum that we, you know, one of the bottlenecks in advancement is going to be, in addition to hardware, developing hardware, it's the algorithms. And so we don't know what we don't know, just like in the 1960s, right? We don't know what all of the applications are going to be that will run on a quantum computer. We know some of them, but what we know is a small, small subset of the power that we will actually have and the way that these things will actually be used, which I think is very cool.
Do you find it frustrating that when you talk to the majority of the people out there, they seem to struggle with the extremes? They either think it's going to be utopian or dystopian, right?
Yeah.
Like, when you scale your mind into the future based on being somebody that's a little bit closer, obviously your crystal ball is probably as cloudy as mine. What do you think is topian? What do you think a world with quantum computer assistance should look like?
Yeah. So I'm an optimist. And so I spend a lot of, you know, time on the ethics side and thinking about this and talking about this. And so I'm an optimist. I think there are always bumps in the road when we adopt new technologies. And there's been, you know, breakthroughs throughout history. The first, you know, one of the very first being language. Imagine a time before we had language. That itself was an invention, right? And I think when language came around, it probably messed up a lot of things. And ultimately, it's been a really beautiful, powerful tool to enable us to do all the things that we've done since then. So, of course, you know, fast forward, I think things like AI and quantum, they bring in a lot of disruption. And I think what people worry about is that they can amplify some of the, you know, maybe the darker sides of humanity. And there's been examples of that, right? You know, there's this example of North Point software where they used AI to help inform judges on how they should decide on parole cases. And they trained it on historical data. And of course, that historical data from court cases and court decisions turned out to be racist, right? And so the decisions that it was turning out were, again, racist. And so that's obviously, we don't want that. We want it to bring out the you know, what the better angels of human nature. And I think because we're thinking and talking a lot about that, and again, bumps in the road are very informative and they'll help us get to a better place. So when I think about kind of what the utopian side, what that looks like, I think there's a future in which technology plays a very enabling role for everybody and helps level the playing field for everyone. And I talk a lot about bringing everybody into the conversation. I think quantum AI, these types of technologies can be intimidating in their verbiage. But there are always different levels at which to talk about things. And I think there is a way to get everybody to be able to understand the impacts of quantum, of AI, no matter where you are in the world or life, and to bring everybody into the conversation so that everybody is helping shape how this develops and the policy around it. And so I think that is critical to get us to that utopian side where these advanced technologies actually do help everybody kind of ascend to a higher level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And you know, take care of a lot of the basic things for us so we can live on the other side again for everybody. I think that's a critical piece of it, not just for a subset of people, but I think it needs to be for everybody.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like when I think about things that we're dealing with right now, where, you know, the places where we get a lot of our battery components are awful. Right. Mm-hmm. It actually reminds me of a Jay Leno conversation about horses. He was talking to someone who was saying that the electric cars will kind of kill what he loves about classic muscle cars. Mm-hmm. And he reminded them about what we thought when locomotives came in and there were horses. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that, you know, locomotives actually took a lot of the jobs away from horses. Mm-hmm. But look how their lives changed. They used to be utility animals. They used to be worked to death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now they're recreational animals predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that has really shaped what their experience would be. And mm-hmm. when we look at these horrible places in the world, if we could mine with robots, you know, that would mean that there's no children there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, again, very, very spot on. And I think for some reason, this stuck with me. I read a Walter Isaacson book, and he was talking about, at the end, he was kind of talking about, you know, he's now a famous writer. And he said, now I'm an editor. I'm not a writer anymore. And that, you know, that enables him to be a bit freer to shape the narrative, to do the other things other than the kind of, you know, nitpicking every sentence. And that stuck with me because I think there are avenues for technology to kind of take over the things that are less, that are more rote and enable us to kind of live more in the creative space and using those technologies to get us to free us up to do that.
Yeah. So you were talking a little bit about algorithms, and is it wrong to say that understanding how quantum approaches things and the algorithms that it's going to have is like some type of operational process is the way to make defense?
So say that one more time.
So you were suggesting, what did you refer to? Was it Shor's algorithm?
Yeah.
And that's the way to essentially break in, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And understanding that is the way to make a defense.
Mm. Yes. I would say so. So actually there's a suite of algorithms, and NIST has been working on this competition where a lot of really smart mathematicians and groups have put forward, here are some different mathematical structures that we can use for cryptographic algorithms that are not vulnerable to a Shor's attack or, in theory, kind of quantum type of logic. And so that's exactly right. Yeah, we understand how the quantum computer would break down the problem. shores or otherwise, and then come up with like complex mathematical structures that that trick the way that the quantum computer thinks. And so that's how those algorithms are put in place.
It's so complicated, and I'm sure that you have to be multidisciplinary. So as someone who's a leader in this space, is it a good understanding that says that you you can talk to the experts, the people that are deep into math? Mm-hmm. you can take from them or understand them, mm-hmm. and the people that are deep into like quantum physics, you can take and understand them. Am I describing you right in saying that you are the link? You're the one who can explain it to us?
Ooh, you know, to some degree. I'm not going to be able to explain it to the degree that some of these really smart brains who are developing these algorithms can. But the takeaway, I think, is what's important, right? The takeaway that this is going to stand up against this XYZ. And also, I think, of note, right, as we enter into this AI and quantum era, in a powerful way, I think on the cybersecurity side, it's important to know as well that nothing stands up forever, right? So even new algorithms will fail at some point. So it's also, and I think that's a key takeaway when we talk about interpolating or kind of translating what these things mean. They will fail, whether it's quantum or otherwise. They'll last several years, but it's really an opportunity to start thinking about how we become more resilient and how we become more adaptable. I think not just in cybersecurity, but in everything, right? Putting in structures that allow us to say, okay, this is good for now. Kind of like puzzle pieces. I can swap it out when the time comes. And right now, a lot of things, especially in the cybersecurity world, are very fixed. And then, you know, when something happens, it's a disaster because we've got to rip stuff out and put new stuff in. And so it's almost a new era of, okay, let's be fast, agile, and be able to adapt to whatever the world and all of this advanced technology that's coming faster and faster throws at us.
So is that how you describe the problems that you're solving as chief product officer?
I would say that for sure. I think that's really what it boils down to. It's this idea of resilience and this idea of adaptability. Yesterday I heard cybersecurity being described as, cyber professionals are traditionally standing behind trees, and the attackers are the ones that are throwing rocks, and traditionally we're trying to build bigger, stronger trees that we can hide behind. But I think it's time, and using the quantum threat really as a catalyst to bring about even more positive change in how we handle data privacy and security. And instead of just building stronger trees, we get out there in the forefront and be able to, adapt to the battlefield and even be more proactive and change the flow of who's advancing on who, right?
Absolutely. And the stakes are so high because yeah. When you take a look, like, has there been a known quantum attack so far?
So we know that we can factor numbers that are not quite as big as the key sizes that we're looking at in terms of like, RSA 2048 or the encryption that we use. Mm-hmm. So you can run kind of subset problems on today's quantum computers. I think it's up for debate too, whether we'll know when it happens or we won't, right? Because there is a lot of private funding that's going into developing quantum computers, we may or may not know. I think a good example is, if you'll remember in World War II, right? Bletchley Park, Alan Turing and his team. The Enigma machine,
Enigma
right?
Enigma machine, yes.
Enigma machine.
I was just talking to Sue Black about this.
Yes, yeah. Oh man, Sue is awesome. I also met her in Austin. She's super cool. She saved Bletchley Park, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. An example, right? So the Nazis would they were emboldened because they used this new fancy way to encrypt data, and they just sent it over, plain radio so anyone could listen in, but they were like, no one can understand it because it's properly encrypted. Well, you know, Alan Turing and the gang figured out how to break the Nazi codes. And so they were able to listen in, collect and decrypt the data, and they kept it secret, right? The Nazis had no idea that they'd broken the code. So they were able to say, or they were able to look in and understand what the strategies were and get ahead of them. And, you know, of course, save countless lives and end the war a lot earlier. And beautiful example of the good guys winning. But, you know, flip it around, right? Some entity secretly breaking our codes and we don't know, and we're still, you know, sending data back and forth. And that's,
number one principle of intelligence is don't reveal your intelligence.
Exactly. Right.
So they're not going to celebrate it when they figure it out. They're just going to continue making it harder and make, and also, there was a movie on that. And they were talking about how the idea is you can't use the knowledge to solve everything. You have to solve the most important things or they'll understand that it's been decrypted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair. The things that like it really kind of puts into play. Mm-hmm. So when we're kind of scaling this out and saying like, oh, okay, in that example, there was like a frequency that we could catch, but then the message was encrypted. Mm-hmm. And now we're like, I don't know, 10,000 chess games into this.
Mm-hmm.
So now the frequencies are encrypted and the messages inside of them are encrypted. Mm-hmm. And there's things that are rolling codes and other things that are like more advanced, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so to bring it back to your question of, you know, what is my job from data, it's to understand where we are in the chess game. And again, there's many layers to this chess game. And say, okay, how do we build a new game of 3D chess where we're at the driver's seat and we can kind of put in and pull out pieces as needed to make this a new genre of the game.
So all of these people that are in startups, like when we were at South by Southwest, I think you and I were on a rooftop together at one point.
Yes. Yeah.
And and we're sitting with some people that are incredible, right? Like we've got David Hudson there from Big Human, obviously Whirly from StrangeWork, StrangeWorks, our team from ArisMD, and a few other amazing people. Sue, I'm missing people. But in that moment, when we think about this group that is looking to build the future, that is looking to take on the problems, who do you call to? Like if you could have the best team out there, I know that you want people that are interested in math and quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
Who else makes up the great minds at QSecure?
Oh my gosh.
What type of people?
Well, I think my team is pretty darn awesome. Joe being one of them. I have some really, really incredible people on the team. A number of people who come out of sort of, you know, in intelligence circles, like we were talking about out of government. So people who kind of understand, even if they can't really talk about it, they understand what's going on out there and what the, especially kind of the international dynamics are. I think, you know, in building any team, I really like to bring in, newbies who can bring new thought to it. And I'd say in some ways I'm very much that as well. I didn't come from a cybersecurity background. So I like always having people who can bring new thought, to it. And I think we can also leverage a lot of outside work and partner a lot. But if I could build a team of everyone I love in the quantum space, there's a lot of people that I worked with on the World Economic Forum report on governance. 'Cause again, that's something I just care so much about. That I would love to bring in to talk about how we build this in a way that protects everyone for the future. So many brilliant people. What I'll say about the quantum ecosystem is that I've heard this so many times, and I agree. There aren't a lot of assholes in quantum, and I love that because it makes everything better and good people make good stuff is what I'll say.
I would totally agree. You know, like the I always try to surround my people with even like I feel as though I can find potential emerging and proven talent. But the thing that they have to have in common is high trust.
High trust. Oh, 100%.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of fit in or fuck off.
Yeah.
It really like it's what makes teams. You know, like everybody thinks that a great team is somebody who has your back, but I truly believe it's great teams have your ankles. They know that you are going to, you need to have the confidence to go too far and know that they're going to save you from yourself.
Yeah.
And I also find the same thing. I don't think that I just don't think the people that have a ton of self-interest are looking to pave the way to the future this early. They want to make sure that there's proven money in there. What's in it for me, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting at?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, startups are able to disrupt big companies a lot of the time is because you see kind of innovation calcifying as you get a lot of those structures in place. But I think I love the idea. You've got your ankles, right? We're going to go out on a limb. We're going to take risks. We're going to do scary stuff that we might not be ready for. But that trust is so, so foundational that we're all going to have our back. And when shit hits the fan, we're all going to be there, you know, at our desks at 2 a.m. And we've got each other's back. And I think that's so important.
So talk to me about your lead in, right? Like my lead into tech is that I was on the outside, but you know how new people don't see problems the same way as people that are like ingrained into any institution. And that's one of the reasons that you like newbies. That was the same for the team from Aris, is that I had been solving different problems. So I didn't have the known I didn't know the common limits. And that made me approach them differently. And so when you were coming, I believe it was from Stanford, into deciding where you were going to build your career. How did you pick this?
Yeah, that is... That is a great question. If you asked me, of course, you know, 10 years ago where I would end up, it would probably not be here, but I'm so happy that I'm here. I'm so incredibly lucky. And I think really I started out studying symbolic systems at Stanford, and it was kind of this idea of what is a thinking thing and how do you create a thinking thing? So kind of AI.
This is the philosophy of AI.
Yeah, it's the philosophy of AI, and then kind of the computer science side of how might you simulate it.
And do you see a border between thinking and sentient?
Oof, that is the question. That's the question that really got me kind of, you know, I remember starting off school and I signed up for a philosophy class. It was called Truth and Morality. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to get so many answers on what is moral and what is true.
But awesome. You ended up with a fistful of questions?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I had no idea what I was in for. And so, yeah, exactly, right? You know, philosophy does not necessarily answer your questions, but it expands how you think about things. So there was a lot of philosophy of mind in it. And, you know, what if you were to, you know, one thought experiment, if you were to take a perfect scan of all your neurons, and recreate it into the silicon brain, if you were to recreate it in perfectly, is that you, right? It's also the Star Trek thing. If you beam me up, Scotty, are you the same there as you were there?
So you're like cloning your way of thinking into a machine.
Clone your way of thinking into a machine. Yeah. And then does that, you know, is that a genuinely conscious thing? I think there are many different schools of thought and no answers, right? Or a lot of answers, maybe you could say it that way. So I think, we could you know, talk for so long about this, but those exact questions are really what got me on the path of, I went into AI. I also took a year and I traveled the world. And just, you know, met a lot of people from different places and learned about a lot of different ways to think about things. And at one point I even got kidnapped and kind of it sent me into this and very luckily got out and all's good in the end. But I think that was one of the catalysts really that got me thinking about sort of the ethics of technology. Technology is something that's becoming ubiquitous. And how do we, again, flip the script and make technology that gets everyone into a place of abundance, so that, you know, we don't have to be kind of adversarial with each other. You know, that's really my my utopian vision, is something that puts everyone into that place. And so that's really how I ended up here, and then, you know, ultimately got into implementing AI, and then quantum as the being at the very forefront of how we build this thing for that optimistic future.
Okay, I can't mentally walk by you being
right.
So I can't have that in the middle of a sentence and then just keep going.
That's totally fair. Yeah, that's definitely a part of my my technology origin story. Funnily enough.
Well, I can pick up what you were laying down in saying that in a world of abundance, you would have not been a resource to kidnappers the same way you were. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, to put it very simply, when you know, you go through something that's hard, it puts you in a place where you're thinking a lot about your frameworks for life. And I think you come out the other side with a different and hopefully stronger framework for how you think about life.
Where were you?
I was in Colombia.
You got kidnapped in Colombia?
Did get kidnapped in Colombia. Yeah. I was volunteering. I was working in a village on the Colombian Amazon, and I got kidnapped. And
you got kidnapped into the jungle?
I did get kidnapped.
Holy crap.
I did. Yeah, I did. I did.
Were you alone? Were there others?
I was volunteering with a couple of people, but I was alone in the kidnapping side of it. Yeah.
And how long?
It lasted a couple of days. Yeah. And I can laugh now, but you know, it was very, very difficult at the time.
I think it's wonderful that you can laugh now.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I've got a 6 and 8 year old daughters, and you're literally making my heart skip.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm always glass half full. And I think, I am so grateful that I've had the chance to see the world and travel and have all these different experiences that really, have shaped who I am today. And yet some of them have been hard. And I think, you know, a lot of people are no stranger to different types of hardship. So sometimes life is like that. And I think, you know, being able to use that as fuel for how you want to bring about a better, better world.
Well, you are a special person to think about, like, being kidnapped, obviously under the threat of death, in a place where this happens all the time and people die all the time. Right.
Absolutely.
Like, I've got to spend some time with Chris Voss, mm-hmm. and he was the head of hostage negotiations for the FBI for 25 years.
Maybe
longer than that. I might be shorting him. But like, when you think about, like, one, how dangerous that was, and then two, to see how full circle you've come around to say, well, if those people weren't in that situation, neither would I have been.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is something that speaks volumes as to who you are and why you're choosing the problem you're choosing to solve.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you come out the other side and you've got to find a way to process it all. And for me, you know, I've always wanted to leave the world a little bit better. I think it's possible. And I think, you know, I think people are neither good nor bad, right? Just like technology is neither good nor bad inherently. And I think, a lot of our circumstance defines, how we end up living and interacting, and kind of this idea of, you know, are you living in scarcity? Are you in a situation where you, you need to kind of say, okay, I'm going to do what it takes to survive and to make it, even if that's at the expense of someone else. And then there's the other side of the spectrum where, you know, you're living in circumstances where you don't have to be in that mindset, and I think that's a really hard one to get to, because there's so many levels to it. It's not just what, you know, what resources you have access to. But I think, you know, that is my utopia, where we have tools so that people can live in that place of internal abundance and be able to kind of be in that compassionate space where we're all just interacting and in a very positive place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that's amazing to hear from somebody who's gone through something like that. And also, like, it speaks to why you would be in a position of leadership now. The way that you're able to gain that perspective and see with empathy, that's got to be something that your team values very much about you.
Yeah. I mean, I, again, have an incredible, incredible team. And we're all fueled by, kind of wherever we're coming from. But I think passion speaks volumes. And I know that, that is one thing that very much drives me to care incredibly about what we're doing. And, if I can be part of a small piece of what moves us forward, and, technology is my lens, right? I think there's many ways to do it. But, if I and we can be part of a small piece of what, I think about data protection as that currently, right? And I think that feeds into AI as well. going back to what does it look like in a quantum era? Things like we have a lot of data out there, and when we have a quantum computer that can break encryption, we'll also, that same quantum computer will be able to make a lot of really sophisticated calculations and correlations on things like, if you've done a 23andMe, that kind of data, or all the data that's out there. So I think data privacy is for me, a really fundamental piece of how we just incrementally build kind of a better foundation. And so, yeah, I am very, very passionate about what I'm doing. And I think that, my background really, really pushes me to that.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So let's say that there was no prevention, that quantum computers became live and were able to, let's say that somebody's intention was to unlock everything that's ever been locked. Mm-hmm. If nobody stopped them, basically within the day this was released, we'd know who shot JFK, whether or not we've been to the moon, like all the secrets would be open. Mm-hmm. Or possessed by a single group. That's crazy. Like, how would we, to think about just the history, like all of the data that could be collected, new or old, mm-hmm. anything that's ever been redacted to suddenly be clear. Like, mm-hmm. that's what you're kind of suggesting when you think quantum WikiLeaks, right?
Yes. Yeah. The fact is that, that quantum at a certain scale will have that ability to, and if that data is protected with, the type of encryption that, what they call asymmetric encryption, then it's vulnerable. So I think, data will be spilled, and it'll be very interesting to know or not know what is now kind of public knowledge. I think, we on our side, we try to, again, from the optimist perspective, say, people need to know that this is a very, very serious threat and a very serious risk. That needs to catalyze the action, and that this is a solved problem. So the faster people move to actually, and that's what we do. We make it easy. So it's just as easy as implementing any kind of software or putting any kind of software into your network. That's as simple as the fix is, right? And I think, people can sometimes get stuck in the, whoa, this is a big problem. And so
it's like so far off, it's not going to affect them.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just a simple software fix. But I think the scale that you're talking about is, is accurate. We need to understand and internalize that, which is a little difficult.
Yeah. Like, even when you take a look at the type of hacking that we see now and what it's capable of and how things can move, this will be something that is, I guess, if we think about trying to compete right now with the threats that we have, it would almost be like trying to swim against Michael Phelps, right? Like the people that are trying to attack are actually really good. Mm-hmm. You know, they're good at what they do and they have very high rewards related to that, right? Mm-hmm. But when we take a look at quantum, it would be like trying to outswim a shark, which is like, you know, at least 10x faster than Phelps.
Yeah, fair.
That's the thing that I think that I keep getting stuck on is, you know, with artificial intelligence being able to change and morph, like you can make videos with as much audio as there is of me on the internet. Somebody could simulate my audio.
Yeah.
We think about having to have like safe words with my kids.
Yeah.
So that nobody can call the school, you know?
Mm-hmm. So our CISO, our chief information security officer, got a call from our COO a few weeks back saying, hey, you know, I need this super secret information for this thing. And luckily, you know, he's a very smart guy and he knew, hey, there's something fishy about this. And it was not our COO. It was exactly what you're talking about, which is nuts. And I think, it is. Quantum is kind of this. It's not the same as data breaches we've faced in the past, right? It's not kind of point wise. Oh, you know, if you were a Target shopper, now your credit card information may be out there. It's blanket statement, right? It's everything. and I think again, it's scary. I think a lot of industries are moving slower than we'd like to see to adopt this. And it may be because, you know, they don't know yet that it is a solved problem. But it's true. And it really kind of, you know, also begs the question, and I think not just quantum, but AI, right? As we move into an era where data is out there, you can simulate people. How do we protect genuine human identity in that era? And I think you were talking about safe words, right? Having a safe word that you know, so if you do get spoofed, right, you know if it's real or not. And a safe word is kind of a crypto key. It's kind of the same thing. So I think you know, we've talked a little bit about this as well. In that kind of era, your identity is kind of your cryptography as well. How do we uniquely identify that I'm me, you're you? Yes, we can talk about sensitive stuff, which is interesting.
When my mind goes down the tunnel, I was thinking about what you were saying earlier about how if you put garbage in, you get garbage out. So like if basically the information that you are deriving from the court system is categorically racist, so will the results, right? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, how is artificial intelligence going to approach this problem? And because they can crunch so much data, I'm really wondering if they're going to actually grade all humans, like Uber drivers grade their passengers, by every keystroke they've ever entered into the internet. And they could see things like trends. So, like, is the trend of what you're trying to solve using the internet showing intelligence or not? Is the things that you participate in showing this? This may be the way that they essentially give us all baseball cards to say like, oh yeah, you know what? Like Brian's really good at math. So we're going to draw on Brian for math, but Brian's got some weird ideas about politics. So we're going to draw on him less for that.
Yeah. But so, you know, kind of a mini example of how that comes into play today is, you know, most of the internet is free for a reason, right?
That's a very kind way to say it's worthless.
No, that's not what I mean. No. I think it's free. I think there is a lot of junk data out there, but I think it's also a beautiful thing that we have access to a lot of really Wikipedia, right? Amazing stuff. And what I mean is a lot of it is free because we are the revenue source. Our data is
the revenue. Oh, we are the product.
We are the product, right? Yeah. And our behaviors and our actions on online are the product. And, you know, it all boils down to online advertising, right? And so, you know, there is an amount of analysis that goes in already to our online behaviors, and it's used largely to sell us stuff that that, you know, analytically we might want, statistically we might want.
So somebody as knowledgeable as you are about security, is there anything that you do as an average person that you're surprised that most people don't?
Ooh. I think, let's see, you know, there's one, the longer your password, the better off you are. So, you know, even if it's a phrase, right. You know, I like going to the store on Tuesdays. That's a lot more safe than like an alphanumeric fancy seven digit password. I think I'm a fan of incognito browsers. Right. I think a lot about kind of how, and my team and I talk a lot about this too, is I think on average, we're not thinking, the general public is not thinking about how our data is being used, and not just how it's used today, largely in terms of advertising, but how it's going to be used in the future. Right. So again, back to that 23andMe example, there's some cool insights that we can gain from genetic information today. But, you know, thinking about how our data is going to be used in the future, to your point, right, as we get more advanced with AI, ultimately quantum, what kind of insights are we going to be able to get out of the data that's already out there? So I think thinking really about how you, one, both put pressure on kind of policymakers to protect our data, and two, how you interact with the digital world, because you know, anytime you're using an app or visiting a website, your data is being collected more often than not, right? So just kind of thinking about how we better own our own data. I think about that a lot.
That's interesting. And then when you think about companies, the thing that you have been saying is this is a solved problem, meaning that like in a world that is about to be full of water, we already have boats. You should get a boat.
Get a boat. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And what size of businesses are you talking to?
Oh man, all kinds. You know, we're talking to both, you know, Fortune 10, and, you know, we just did a deployment with a company that's probably like 7 people. So all kinds, you know, and our model is kind of scale however you want it. Just use it. I think every company, especially companies that handle sensitive data, and I think that's the thing, not everyone needs to worry about this. If you're, you know, a site that displays weather information, right, that maybe that data is not super important to protect for 5-10 years, right? But, you know, again, health records, the shelf life of that is hopefully a very long time for, you know, mine or your health, electronic health records or, bank account information, et cetera. So yeah, all shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm. And that's because this stuff can be a puzzle piece to a much larger puzzle than what you see, right? Mm-hmm. So like it could be that your business gives them this puzzle, but then they have 6 other businesses that are unrelated that complete the puzzle, and suddenly they have access to everything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that we all take a look at that.
Yeah, and well said.
I also think that like one of the stories from the Bible is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's I guess it forms an old joke. What's the best time to build an ark? Before the rain.
Before the rain, yeah. Exactly.
So definitely your message is coming clear. This is a solved problem and the time to act is now. The time to inquire. And people can inquire directly to QSecure. Like you guys are doing deployments and talking to businesses right now, mm-hmm, about the future of their data security.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. We're deploying today. Literally today. I'm in DC doing a deployment.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Very. And again, it's software. It's just, you know, we boil it down to new math, new crypto algorithms, that just kind of overlay the old ones, and you know, we can do this in a day or less, depending on what you want to protect. So yeah, it's simple to build a boat. I think that's the message that we want to get across. Cause again, people tend to get stuck in the, ooh, this is a big, what do they say? How do you eat the elephant?
Yeah.
But it's a simple boat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people keep looking at the global problem, right? Keep looking at like, hey, are we going to end up as pets to machines? You know, and the truth of the matter is that the problems that precede that will be like, is my business compromised in a way that no one will trust me ever again? Mm-hmm. Right. That's probably the biggest concern for financial institutions.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you build the trust back when you let everything go?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so true. Yeah. And your healthcare provider, the people and you were talking about trust before. I think so many things boil down to trust when it comes to, you know, we're humans. We depend on each other. And we depend on digital services run by humans as well. And so I think, it does. It's hard to rebuild that after there's a huge breach of that information that you're entrusting an organization to protect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate you running through as much as we were able to. I'm definitely going to reach out to you in the future and ask you back because this was so fun.
Amazing. I've had so much fun and your questions and ways of putting things are so spot on. I love it. So thank you.
Well, anything that you would like to use again, I would be happy to gift it to you. Everybody has a skill and me being able to kind of wire together analogies is one of mine.
That's awesome.
So thank you so much for joining us. This is Leadership Line of Sight. My name is Taylor, and I'm here with Rebecca Crothamer. She is leading us into a more trusted future when it comes to cybersecurity and what we see is coming next. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.